All right, welcome everybody, and welcome to the eighth edition of the DMSC Masterclass. This monthly class is for current DMSC students and faculty and those interested in the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences, A.T. Still University. And this allows us to hear from inspiring masters in the PA profession and those in healthcare who have actually made a difference. So a few housekeeping issues for our attendees. Please keep your microphones on mute. If you make any comments in the chat section, please do so, and we'll look at those during the presentation. And once we're finished, we'll open it up to questions. And then you can unmute yourself and ask questions. But let me take a minute to introduce our guest today. I'm really excited about this. Greg P. Thomas, PA-C Emeritus, MPH. In addition to being a PA for over 45 years, Greg has been a leader in the field of CME and education. Throughout his career, he has worked with numerous organizations to promote the PA profession. Greg received his bachelor's degree in natural sciences, magna cum laude, in 1975 from Xavier University in Cincinnati, Ohio. An additional bachelor's degree in 1977 from the PA program of the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And he earned a master's degree in public health with a focus on healthcare administration in 1978 from the University of Texas School of Public Health in Houston. Greg began his PA career as a clinical instructor of medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine in 78, and then as the associate director for the University of Texas Health Science Center Dallas PA program the following year. He then moved to the George Washington University Medical Center in Washington, D.C. in 79, and for 13 years, Greg served as assistant director, associate director, and director of the Office of Continuing Medical Education. Greg was the first PA in the country to hold such a position in a major medical center. Greg's impact on the PA profession continued at the American Academy of Physician Assistants, where he worked in many different roles, including the director of industry relations and assistant vice president of industry relations and development. Greg, I think this is when you and I sort of crossed paths during those years. Right. He served as vice president of clinical affairs and education, professional education and industry relations, and professional education and alliance development. From 2008 to 2011, Greg was the senior vice president of education, membership, and resource development. He began a contract role as the director of PA relations with the National Commission on the Certification of PAs, NCCPA, in March of 2011, and recently retired from that position in June of 2022. He continues to serve in an advisory capacity with NCCPA. He also briefly served as a consultant to the PAEA following his departure from AAPA in 2011. It was really Greg's pioneering role as director of the George Washington Medical Center Office of CME that led his participation, including leadership positions with the Alliance for Continuing Medical Education, now the Alliance for Continuing Education in the Health Professions. In September of 92, Greg became one of the very first PAs employed full-time by the AAPA to serve as an external representative of the profession, with a focus initially on the healthcare industry, specifically the pharmaceutical industry, and then extending to managed care, government, and PA and physician organizations, among others. His role at AAPA expanded to include both his external focus and his interest and expertise in CME. So through his role with the AAPA, Greg found himself involved with many organizations as one, if not the only, PA to serve as a representative of the PA profession. Greg's currently a member of the AAPA, the Florida Academy of PAs, and Pi Alpha, National PA Honor Society, and he currently resides in St. Petersburg, Florida, with his partner of more than 30 years to whom he was married in 2013. And Greg, I could go on and on talking about more things, but it's more important to hear from you. But, you know, welcome to our masterclass.
Well, thank you very much, Randy. And first of all, that was an exhausting introduction. And and if it was about any other topic other than me, I probably would have been bored. But that was very generous of you to spend all that time. And I'm really, truly honored to participate in this program. You know, you and I go back a long way and have crossed paths in a variety of different roles, as you mentioned, from early days when you were in leadership at AAPA and I was either volunteering there or had started my role as staff there. So we've known each other a long time and we have some interesting stories we could share, but probably the crowd isn't interested in all of those. But thank you very much for inviting me to participate.
We're really excited about that. But let's get right to it, Greg. You know, you started your career as a clinically practicing PA and educator. You know, and we always want to hear what drew you to the PA profession in those early days. And tell us about your early clinical practice.
Well, you know, it's a fascinating story. And I think it's one that's shared by a lot of PAs of, dare I say, our generation. And that is, you know, I honestly pretty much fell into this profession. No one knew about the PA profession. We're talking in the mid-70s at that time. As you just heard, I graduated from college in 75. And I let me just share a little bit of personal history. You know, I was at a, although not one of the largest schools, at a private Jesuit liberal arts university in Cincinnati. They had a very well-respected and very competitive pre-med curriculum that I was part of. And, you know, I did well in school. There's no question about that. But I must say that there was something occurred at the end of my sophomore year, going into a junior year. And those of you who are aware of how you prepare to apply for medical school, your junior year is really one of the key times. But at that moment in time, I sort of came to this realization that I was at a very good liberal arts school, and I wasn't taking advantage of a lot of the educational opportunities there. And I mean by that, the non-science educational opportunities. You know, there were great English courses. There were great, and no pre-med majors took those courses because God forbid you not get an A in any non-science course. And there was sort of this awakening in me that, you know, I'm missing out on some good opportunities. And I don't mean to sound really all high and mighty or philosophical about that, but maybe it was because it was a Jesuit school and I was forced to take philosophy. Maybe I am a little philosophical, but in any case, I sort of for momentarily kind of put the pre-med thing on a back burner. I didn't change majors or anything. And then during college, I was working at a hospital as an OR tech. And one of the nurses with whom I had become very friendly told me about this program that she had heard about at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston called the PA program. And I said, you know, that sounds really interesting. And I always say this sort of tongue in cheek, if I was interviewing Greg Thomas at that time for an entry into a PA program, I wouldn't have given him the time of day because I knew nothing about the profession. And I, so far as I knew, this was the only program in the country. I mean, it's really sort of embarrassing to admit how little research I did, but I did. I went to Houston, Texas. I interviewed at Baylor. Many of you know who Carl Fasser, by golly, Carl Fasser was the director of the program way back then. I interviewed with him and several others, and long story short, I was accepted to that program and I loaded up my car and I moved to Houston and started the PA program there. And you know, in some respects, I say I've never looked back since then. Whether my thinking going into it was really very solid, I'm not so sure, but certainly the profession I've been well served by the profession. Although I think it's fair to say, you know, you mentioned my clinical role. I'm probably one of the few PAs, at least of our generation, that never really practiced, never full-time clinically, and never practiced a lot clinically, because for a variety of reasons, my career path moved more towards the administrative end of things. And I always find this kind of funny, because my first job after getting my graduate degree, my MPH, was at the University of Texas in Dallas, as Randy mentioned. And, you know, I was a baby, just, you know, fresh out of PA school with this brand new master's degree. I came on as a very junior faculty person. And it was about a half-time clinical job and half-time teaching. And for a variety of reasons, a vacancy appeared because the director of the program was kind of let go. And the medical director of the program sort of turned to me and said, well, Greg, you're the only person on faculty who has a master's degree, so I'm going to make you associate director. And, you know, I was like 20 years old or something like that, you know, but that's kind of how that started. And, you know, it's, who knows, you know, being at the right place at the right time is sort of an interesting thing. And then shortly, you know, my tenure at UT Southwestern in Dallas was a great job. And I was really beginning to enjoy the administrative side of being the associate director. But I was recruited by the person who would turn out to be my lifelong professional mentor, and that's Tom Pym. Many of you know him. Dr. Thomas Pym was my boss at GW. He was one of the very early pioneers and supporters of the PA, a physician, but a supporter of the PA profession. He was the first chair of the NCCPA. He was very involved in a whole variety of different roles. And Tom sort of took an interest in me and recruited me for this new job that he had at George Washington University as director of the office, a newly created office of CME there. And Tom, and I'll never forget this, Tom started, I remember very clearly him saying to me, I have an alternative vision for the physician PA partnership. You know, everyone thinks about it in a clinical perspective. And he said, why don't you and I make that administrative partnership? You know, he was the director of the office at that point, went on to become a dean, and ultimately I became director of the office. But, you know, it was an interesting way that MD-PA partnership sort of worked in more of an administrative setting. And I must say, my experience at George Washington University in that CME office was a very interesting one, because I hesitate to use the term, but I will anyway. We had a pretty entrepreneurial enterprise there, because not only did we conduct CME activities for the university and for the largely physician community in Washington, D.C. area, but we got involved with some other national organizations managing their meetings and other aspects of things, which got me an introduction into a couple of different organizations. And as Randy said, in all of those cases, I was the only PA ever to be involved. I mean, I think, you know, still we're talking in the late 70s and early 80s, where the PA, although George Washington University certainly had a PA program, so PAs were known there, still around the country, there wasn't a lot of recognition of the program. So in any case, my career became much more administrative as time went on.
Yeah, excellent. You know, since you brought up Carl Fasser, I have to tell you, this past week, I was in Charlotte at the Doctoral Summit and had dinner with Carl.
Oh, my goodness.
And Carl is as curmudgeon as he's ever been. And
before we leave Houston, I have another anecdote that I love to tell. This I'm embarrassing myself by showing how little forethought I have about my career path. But when I graduated from the PA program in 77, I should look this up. I don't know how many PAs there were in 77, but not very many. And that meant there weren't a lot of great jobs around at that time either. So I was in Houston. I was kind of loving life in Houston. And this is probably way more than people care about, but I think it's very amusing. So I had a roommate at that time. And one of my non-academic things that I enjoyed was playing bridge. And one of my roommate's friends was the librarian at the UT School of Public Health Library. And we were playing bridge, and she said, so what are you going to do when you finish this PA program? And I said, you know, Stephanie, I honestly don't know. And she said, you should get an MPH. You know, there's never been a PA who has enrolled in our MPH program at UT. And I'm like, well, that sounds like a good idea. So that's about how much thought I put into that too. So sorry for that, but I love that anecdote, actually.
That's great. Well, you know, as I said earlier, you and I crossed paths early with AAPA. I mean, I can't remember when I first started as a leader at AAPA that I didn't go to a meeting that you weren't there.
Yeah.
You know, whether it was the annual meeting or leadership meetings, or you remember the constituent chapter officers workshops back in those days. You know, what I guess the question really is, what drew you to the AAPA? And then your role in industry relations and CME over the years.
Well, you know, I think you sort of nailed it. Number one, I was like a lot of PAs, had multiple years of volunteer experience on various committees of the AAPA. And I think also because of the fact that I lived in Washington, D.C., and AAPA was in Northern Virginia, I frequently did attend board meetings. They were open to the public. I was interested in what was going on. So I kind of had an informal connection with AAPA all along. And because of that, I got to know a lot of staff people and various others. And then in 92, AAPA had recently hired a new CEO who frankly didn't last very long, but he and I had some multiple conversation, and he was interested in getting in the organization having more of an external outreach kind of role, and thought that having a PA involved in that was a good idea. And so that's kind of how it all came about. I was recruited for a position at AAPA, and the initial, as Randy mentioned earlier in that very long introduction, the initial focus was really reaching out to industry, primarily the pharmaceutical industry, because, you know, at that point in time, there just wasn't a lot of awareness of the PA profession. And that started, that's how it sort of started out. And I think, you know, it's also fair to say that, as I think everyone who listens to this will know, particularly back then, the pharmaceutical industry had a lot of resources, a lot of financial resources that they made available to professional organizations. And, part of our goal was to get them to recognize the PA profession, and to be very frank, to help support the AAPA and the PA profession financially and otherwise. And so I became sort of in some respects, like a one-man marketing show to the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, as I'm sure you're all aware, in the early and mid-90s, I mean, PAs couldn't even prescribe in probably only less than half the states. The number kept increasing pretty dramatically. But there were certainly smart people in the pharmaceutical industry that realized that even if PAs couldn't actually prescribe, they were clearly making prescribing decisions. And so I think, I'm not going to claim credit for it, but there was sort of a gradual shift in the way pharmaceutical companies began to look at the PA profession. And I must say that it was really kind of a fun, challenging, but also fun to present to what I would recall as like naive audiences that were naive to the PA profession, and really see eyes open up like, really, PAs do all those things? And that was a lot of fun. And then that role at AAPA expanded to beyond the pharmaceutical industry, certainly, and into managed care was becoming a big issue at the time. And I even became sort of a point person with some of the physician organizations, which was also, frankly, a lot of fun and challenging, and a lot of fun as well. So that role at AAPA certainly was a good 13 years of my life.
Well, I wish we had lots of time to get into each organization, but you have a longstanding service to the profession and just all of your professional organization. And correct me if I'm wrong now, but I think you're the only PA to have hit the trifecta. What I mean is that you've worked for the AAPA, the NCCPA, the PAEA. I don't know. You might even work for the FBI, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know. But tell us more about, that experience. We'll talk more about NCCPA in a minute. But, yeah, having worked for all three.
Well, let me just say, there's a really funny story about that. And there's a very well-respected PA leader whose name I will not mention, but I know that most PAs know him. And Randy, you're an example of this too. There are PAs who have held leadership positions in the various PA organizations, in some cases been president of multiple national PA organizations. And this one PA who I consider a good friend one time said to me, they had a personal goal of being president of X number of the, and I said, well, that's nice, but I intend to be employed by all PA, national PA organizations. And I almost made it. You call it the trifecta. I used to, back when John McCarty was the executive director of ARC-PA, he used to say, can't you just hire me to do anything just for a week so I can claim to have been employed by all four? But no, I don't mean to be too silly about that. But as far as I know, there's no one else has been employed by AAPA, PAEA, and NCCPA, and that's been a lot of fun. And you know, there's certainly, I am in no way, shape, or form taking away from the invaluable role that volunteer leaders play in those organizations. And obviously, the PA organization is led by volunteer members of their boards of directors and the leaders, et cetera, et cetera. But there's sort of a different aspect of being, if you pardon the expression, on the inside as a staff person. And you know, frankly, it's been a lot of fun, and to sort of see sort of some of the behind the scenes, if you will, operations of things. As everyone knows, you know, that the staff of organizations don't make all of the strategic decisions, certainly. That's left to the boards of directors to provide the direction. But it's been fun being on the inside of those various organizations.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the NCCPA for a minute. I know you were and are a spokesman. You and I have crossed paths at so many state conferences talking about the commission. And I know you've done hundreds of presentations.
I'm not surprised. The university competition to advance.
Nope, I'm sorry. I'm getting feedback from Alexa. You know, I should have turned Alexa off. But anyway, so you provided lots of presentations on behalf of the NCCPA. And there tends to be a sort of a love-hate relationship between PAs and the commission. And of all people at the conferences, you were a great representative in sharing your as a PA and as part of the NCCPA. And so, you know, some say that NCCPA does not represent the needs of the PA profession. What are your thoughts about all that stuff that goes on?
Well, you know, I have lots of thoughts about that. And it was an interesting thing, you know, for what now 12 years serving as kind of the external spokesperson, for, not the only, but the primary one speaking to PA audiences about what was going on with NCCPA. And I think, you know, there's sort of a natural antagonism, that's a pretty strong word, but I'll say antagonism between regulatory bodies, in our case, a certifying body, and the profession that is being certified. And that's certainly not unique to PAs. If you look at, and I think for those of us who followed that in the news, you over the last several years, there's been a lot of controversy in the physician world among physicians and their various specialty boards around a whole lot of different issues and all that. So I think some of that is natural. I think that the fact that, I don't think, I'm pretty sure, the fact that in our world that the certification maintenance process includes some periodic assessment of what we at NCCPA have called core medical knowledge, when many PAs would say they don't do core medical knowledge sorts of need that kind of core medical knowledge in their practice, makes us a little bit different than some of our physician some of our physician colleagues and their relationship with their specialty boards. So that has clearly, I mean, I think when most PAs, if they have a negative perspective of NCCPA, most frequently it's around PANRI. It's not around NCCPA or the individuals at NCCPA. I mean, sometimes it may be, but generally it's around the recertification or the exam part of the certification maintenance process. And frankly, I think PANRI LA, and I'm not going to get out on that soapbox, you know, I spent a couple of years talking about that. And honestly, I'll say it was a lot of fun to talk about that because it was a very positive step forward. And of course, not 100% of PAs think it's a great thing, but most PAs have a very positive perception of that form of knowledge assessment versus the super high stakes PANRI as we're all familiar with it in the past. But I think the bottom line is, in our profession, in my opinion, and I think it's fair to say in the position of NCCPA, the generalist credential that is a PAC has allowed for flexibility in the PA profession. And I think there are many people, I believe, that flexibility is one of the hallmarks of our profession. It's something that we have uniquely. You know, we're always compared to nurse practitioners, and I'm not going to get into anything about us versus them in that regard. But, you know, most nurse practitioners have their certification, their credential, not all, but most are more siloed and in a specialty area. And our generalist certification has allowed PAs a lot of flexibility. And if you look at the data is very clear that most PAs, far and away most PAs, have changed specialties over the courses of their careers and frequently multiple times. And I think you look at the experience of the pandemic where PAs pivoted from one, you know, I'm sure you all are familiar with the anecdotes of PAs who worked in, let's say, in like orthopedic surgery, who were pivoted into a role in more critical care kinds of things that not a lot of physicians were even able to do. So that generalist DNA of the PA profession, I believe, has served us really well. And part of the price to pay for that is a generalist credential. You know, and I always said when speaking on behalf of NCCPA, is that always going to be the case? You know, are we inevitably going to move into the direction of specialty certification like our physician colleagues? And, you know, I think the jury's out on that. I will say without giving away any secrets, you know, the leadership and the board of directors of NCCPA talks about that. Not that they're going to do it tomorrow or next year, but talk about is that the future of the PA profession? The last thing I'll say is, you know, I think having worked at AAPA and then go to work for NCCPA, I mean, I will say I had colleagues at AAPA said, oh my God, you're going to the dark side. So that's sort of built in, whatever you want to call it, between AAPA and NCCPA has always existed. And, you know, naturally so. One is the professional advocacy organization, AAPA, and one is more of a regulatory body, the certifying body. And I used to say to PA audiences, you know, it's there's some analogies to a marriage or some other kind of relationship. And the relationship in that marriage has not always been blissful. And there have been times when it got really rocky and there were times when it almost came to divorce. Right now, I will say it's in a pretty good shape. But I used to say, you know, it's kind of like keeping with the marriage analogy. If mom and dad are screaming at each other and the kids are like in the living room trying to watch TV, they don't want to hear that. And, you know, and I heard from a lot of PAs, particularly, and it, luckily it was several years or more than several years ago, when the relationship between AAPA and NCCPA was really bad. And, you know, PAs were saying, you know, take it to another room. Don't have this fight in public. And I think we were kind of fighting. And that's not one side or the other's fault. But the good news is we're not like that anymore. Or we're not in that situation anymore. So sorry for getting off on that tangent, but I really don't think the kids, that is PAs, wanted to see two of the major organizations sort of fighting in public.
Yeah, and well said. And another thing that you've talked about a lot in your presentations is the difference in the leadership at NCCPA. When I first started in the NCCPA, it was a majority physicians on the board. Talk a little bit about how that's changed over the years.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier that my mentor and dear friend, Tom Pym, who passed away not so long ago, but, you know, he in essence created the NCCPA. And when NCCPA, it was created in 78, think of it. I mean, many of you who listened to this probably weren't in the profession back then, but without the buy-in, if you will, of organized medicine, specifically the AMA and other of the major players in medicine, if they weren't behind particularly the way PAs were going to be credentialed, you know, we wouldn't be talking about this right now because there probably ended up being 15 PAs and that would have been the end of that. So when NCCPA was created, it was by plan, a physician-dominated organization. The AMA had a lot of power and other groups of organized medicine. There were always PAs involved, and AAPA was always involved. But like Randy just said, if you look at the board of directors of NCCPA, even as recently as 15 years ago, it was much larger, and it was mainly physicians, representing a lot of different physician groups like American College of Surgeons, American Academy of Pediatrics, et cetera, which was good. But to the credit of the NCCPA board of directors, most of whom were physicians themselves, they made the intentional decision to number one, reduce the size of the board, and number two, make it a PA majority board. So this wasn't like a coup on the part of PAs alone. This was with the support of the physician leaders at that time. And so when you look at the NCCPA board right now, it is the clear majority are PAs. There's still physician representation, which I happen to, not all PAs agree with this, but I happen to believe having physicians at the table, you know, as part of the deliberations of decisions that, that affect a PA certification center is a good thing. But clearly, it's a majority PA or, leadership at this point.
Yeah. And before we go past NCCPA, talk a little bit about the CAQs. You know, back in the day when we first started the CAQs, there was some thoughts that they would never continue, that they would never be successful. A lot of controversy about that. Your thoughts about the value or the future of CAQs?
Boy, you're really putting me on the spot with that one. Well, you know, it's an interesting question, Randy, because I think you were in NCCPA leadership at that time, and I was kind of an AAPA, I almost said spy, but I'll say an AAPA liaison representing AAPA in some internal discussions at NCCPA about CAQs. And I'll say very candidly, you know, AAPA was opposed to the concept, for the fear of that it would lead to specialty certification, that it would for all those grand words I just said a while ago about the generalist credential allowing flexibility, the concern was, and it's a legitimate concern, I think, that once there is a specialty specific credential, that it could become required for employment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So those concerns are legitimate. I see that. However, I think NCCPA has created this program, and I'll say very candidly, not that anyone might care, but I wasn't a proponent of the CAQ at the beginning, but I've grown to appreciate it. And it is a voluntary thing. I always said when I was standing behind the podium representing NCCPA that it's, if I dare I say, fake news to suggest that NCCPA is secretly trying to convince every PA to get a CAQ or every employer to require a CAQ, et cetera, et cetera. The fact is the number of the uptake, if you will, of the CAQs that exist today is relatively low, given the fact that there are about 170,000 PAs now, and there's about 2,400 CAQs that have been awarded. But, you know, there's stories that PAs who have a CAQ, they've been very useful in some respects. So the bottom line is, I think it's a useful tool. I can tell you that NCCPA remains committed to the program. For those of you who aren't aware, there were initially five CAQs, two more were added ages ago, two more were added last year, and two more are being developed. So, you know, the number of specialties in which a CAQ will be available and continues to grow, but the uptake is pretty low. So.
Excellent. No, right on target. Well, let's move on to some other fun topics. In 2017, the AAPA House of Delegates approved optimal team performance, OTP. What are your thoughts on OTP? Is it enough? Is it too much? You know, what's the word out there?
Okay, so this is great. This is a wonderful thing to be in a semi-retired position. And I'm going to say that I'm speaking absolutely for myself, not in any way for NCCPA, certainly not for AAPA. Let me just say the positives first. You know, the momentum to modernize state laws and regulations to reduce the burdens of unnecessary supervisory requirements, outdated laws about, you know, ratio, physician PA ratios and things like that, I mean, is a wonderful thing and deserves the support of all PAs and all PA organizations, et cetera, et cetera. Personally, I didn't understand the need to put a label on that. And so I think optimal team practice has been misused, not so much by PAs, but by, shall we say, those who are concerned about PAs moving forward too aggressively, i.e. some of our physician colleagues. The terminology of optimal team practice has been used as, aha, It's just code words for independent practice. And, you know, that's a whole nother topic. Whether the PA profession should move in that direction is one thing that, you know, that's time. That's a whole nother masterclass. But my personal opinion is there was no need to label the movement towards modernizing PA laws and regulations. And, you know, even from the years, many years ago when I was at AAPA, the state advocacy folks would talk about the six key elements of what was good PA legislation, if you will. And those six key elements still exist. And OTP represents those, but the six key elements, in my humble opinion, didn't need a special name. So I think the need for change is really important, and I fully support it. And AAPA deserves a lot of credit. You know, for those of you, I hope you keep track, you know, you look at the year by year, the legislative wins across the country are major. Whether you call it OTP or you just call it good advocacy work, a lot has been changed. So that's good.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, even before it was OTP, it was FPAR. Remember that?
Right, Full Practice Authority.
Yeah. It's amazing. Well, since we're talking about that, let's move on to the title change. You know, to physician associate, approved by the House and then sort of ratified by the AAPA, and we've changed our name. And in fact, you know, today I was watching TV and there's an AAPA commercial, you know, that talks about that PAs moving forward. So what's your thought about the title change?
Okay, so I will say again, I'm speaking just for myself, not any organization. Obviously, you know, the AAPA has changed their name. So it's the American Academy of Physician Associates. NCCPA has not done that yet. Although that's certainly a topic of conversation within NCCPA. PAEA took an interesting approach and they just used PA, which I think, so I'll just say, since you ask, and since I love to give my opinion, I'm not in favor of the change. But when I say that, I think every PA, certainly every PA that I've ever talked to, and I've talked to thousands of them, thinks that the title physician assistant grossly underestimates the value that PAs bring to the marketplace, if you will. So that part of it, I'm not going to quibble with. Physician associate, whether that's a better or not, you know, we can talk about that for a long time. I actually thought AAPA was really smart several years ago. At first, I thought it was silly. And then the more I thought about it, I was like shrewd. And that is to just quit, just say PA. And in my experience, that, you know, there's few people I run into, and I'm talking about like in my personal life, when people say, what do? You say, I'm a PA. I mean, most people now know what a PA is, has had experience interacting with a PA or has a PA as a niece or nephew or cousin or whatever. So, you know, I think it may be a silly thing and it was a way to sort of dodge the bullet. But I think my major concern about this is the enormous amount of resources it's going to take to make this change. And, you know, it's been 2 years, no states one state has taken a little step forward, but no states have changed laws or anything. So although I fully recognize and support the thought behind it, I just, to be blunt, I think focusing on modernizing state laws is better use of resources than the title change. But this is Greg Thomas, old Greg Thomas talking about this. I am not representing, let me be crystal clear, I'm not talking for NCCPA at this point.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, getting back to OTP, I thought that the best part of OTP was the one that recommended that states try to work toward PA-centric regulatory boards in the state.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
As you know, five or six, Arizona being one of them, has, and I served on that board, made a huge difference because the majority of PAs were on the regulatory board. I thought putting efforts into that years ago would have put us much further down the road because you have much say so in the state.
Yeah, let me just add to that, Randy, because I will say, you know, several years ago, pre-pandemic, NCCPA made the decision to do some outreach to state medical boards to do presentations about, you know, because as everyone knows, at least initially, all states require that PAs graduate from an accredited PA program and pass our certification exam. We won't get into whether you need to be currently certified to relicense or not. But so, you know, state medical boards know about NCCPA. They know about the PAC credential. And Don Morton Rias, who's the CEO of NCCPA, thought, you know, this is an audience, this is a constituency group of ours that we should have some sort of relationship with. And so we did a lot of presentations to state medical boards. I myself did about a dozen. And I will just say, I talk about the scales falling from your eyes. I was amazed in a very negative way, to be blunt. The presenting to these boards who control the, in many respects, the professional lives of PAs. Number one, well, with one exception, there were no PAs on the board. And frankly, I'm not convinced any of those people on the board knew what the PA, you know, that was like, wow. So I agree with you completely. Yeah. Megan. That's a particular area where speaking of regulatory bodies, those are serious regulatory bodies who need to have PA representation for sure. So
yeah, right on. Well, we're heading in the home stretch, but as you know, last week I was able to attend the doctoral summit sponsored by PAEA, where there were about 50 or 60 thought leaders of the profession from all walks of the profession who talked about, we're talking about the entry level doctorate for PAs. As you know, the PAEA will be looking at that this year and deciding whether they want to change their current stance or not. Do you have a thought on entry-level doctoral degrees? I know I've asked you a lot of tough questions tonight.
But... No, I do. Of course, I have thoughts. And I'm going to say, now I'm repeating for the third time that I'm speaking for me personally. And you know, I'll say very honestly, I have very mixed views on this because, you know, I fully support PAs who choose to pursue higher degrees, doctoral degrees. And your degree, your DMSC is a great example of that. And obviously a lot of career PAs who've been in their career for a long time opt to do that for a variety of reasons. I fully support that. I must say that I still have personally some reservations about making it an entry-level degree because for lots of different reasons that everyone has talked about for quite a long period of time. But, you know, if I was in a position to have to make that decision, I don't think I'm ready to make it yet in terms of for or against. And from what I gather from that august body that you just described, that there is still that sense of we're not really sure whether we're going to move in that direction yet or not. But I'm not opposed. You know, some people are flat out opposed to it. I'm certainly not have that position. So I think in the interest of time, we'll just kind of leave it at that.
Oh, that's fair. So Greg, many of our DMSC students are either PAs in education or they're wanting to move into education or they're interested in leadership or some sort of administrative opportunities, or they just want to gain some skills to enhance their clinical acumen. So what would be your advice to our DMSC students and graduates about their future and the future of the PA profession?
Well, first of all, I applaud, as I said earlier, I applaud particularly PAs who've been in it for a good while going and pursuing a graduate degree. And I know quite a few PAs who have done it, including some of your own graduates or those who are students in your program. And I definitely applaud that. I mean, I think we look at the data and for the most part, you know, PAs are clinicians who have busy clinical jobs, who are busy taking care of the needs of their patients, which of course is really what we're all about, right? But I think sometimes we being a profession, has missed opportunities because we've been so clinically focused that we miss the opportunity to get involved in potentially some leadership or administrative roles in healthcare systems. Now, I believe that's changing. And certainly if you listen to, you know, AAPA has exerted put some resources in that direction in terms of leadership development and things like that. But getting involved in administrative levels, particularly in this time where everything is about health systems, you know, there are no private practices basically. So if it's the old proverb about if you don't have a seat at the table, as my dear former colleague and dear still friend Ann Davis said, if you don't have a seat at the table, you're on the menu. And that's true. You know, you think about, there's not a leadership team in any health system or any whatever that doesn't include physicians and nurses and probably pharmacists. But, you know, PAs, not so frequently. Now, it's getting better, certainly. So my advice is, you know, if you're about to get your DMSC and you're going to have your new highfalutin degree, if you will, to use that in a way in your system to this, if it means forcing yourself into positions on committees. You don't have to be the chair or whatever, but, you know, one thing leads to another. And I think I'm a huge advocate for our profession. Trust me, I'm a rabid supporter of the PA profession, but I think this is an area where we've kind of missed it, that we've, and this sounds horrible to say, but that as a profession, we've been so focused on clinical medicine and providing great care to patients, and PAs do provide exceptional care to patients, but we may have missed an opportunity by not allowing ourselves to get involved in more administrative or leadership kinds of activities. So I think programs like this just pave the way for that to happen.
Great. Well, I'm going to open it up for some questions while people are thinking about that. But let me start first, you know, Greg, with your sort of busy, semi-retired schedule, what do you do for fun?
Well, I don't really have a busy semi-retired schedule. So. No, I think it's fair to say, I don't know who all will be listening to this, but, you know, if you're at that almost retirement or sort of retired age, it's a fascinating thing of life to sort of figure out what you're doing with your time. I do still have some kind of minor advisory role with NCCPA, which takes a little bit of time. And I was recently elected to the Board of Trustees of the PA History Society, which I used to always say tongue in cheek was, you know, for all the old farts. And now guess what? I am one of them. So, But I'll personally, you know, you mentioned earlier, my husband and I have only been married for about 10 years, but we've been together for 30 plus years. And we divide our time between beautiful St. Petersburg, Florida. And we recently purchased a condo in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. There's a long story there, but we don't need to talk about that here. And we have a boat. We love boating. I love walking around the neighborhoods of Florida. I try to do that daily. I read a lot. I will say thanks for asking about my personal time, because my newest thing is I continue to explore ways to do volunteer work. And one of my newest fascinations is I want to become a docent at a museum, because as you can probably tell, I love to talk. And a friend of mine pointed this out a couple of years ago, said, you know, when you retire, you need to become a docent, because you've never met some, you know, an opportunity that you didn't like to talk about. So that's what I'm pursuing right now.
Oh, that's great. Let's see. Hold on here. I've got Hang on. So Eric asks, any advice on how to expand the profession in Canada?
Oh man. Well, that's way above my pay grade. So the simple answer is no, I don't. I mean, you know, I think one of the things, and again, I'm not speaking on behalf of NCCPA, but it's certainly one of the things that's considered is, you know, will there ultimately be some reciprocity about our credentials? Because we currently have a different set of or a different credentialing process in Canada and the US. I know I'm sort of dodging the question, but as everyone knows, you know, the PA profession is kind of popping up all over the world, and there has definitely been interest expressed about some sort of reciprocal credentialing process and all that. But so far as I know, there's not a lot of action, even in Canada, right to our north, of making that happen right away. So the simple answer is that's out of my bailiwick, but I don't know. I have no advice in that regard.
All right. Other questions from the folks who are here? Not that you have to, but and I know we've gone on almost 50 minutes now, and for many people it's getting late, but any last minute questions? Okay, well, once again, Craig, Greg, thank you so much for your time participating in our masterclass. It's been very enjoyable. Any last comments before I wind this up?
Not at all, but I just will say again, thank you so much. I'm honored to have been asked to participate in this. As you can tell, I love talking, period. And I love talking about the profession. And although I got here in kind of a weird way, as I described earlier, I'm just so delighted that things turned out the way they did. I unfortunately, that nurse who I mentioned early on, who was a colleague at the hospital I worked at when I was in college, passed away several years ago, but I always felt like I should reach out and thank her because she introduced me to this and so made it all possible. But back to the point, thank you very much for including me. It was an honor.
Well, thank you. And thanks to everybody who's here tonight or listening to this. Please join us in April. We have a date to be determined for our next masterclass. It's going to be with Dawn Morton Rios. Greg knows her very well, president and CEO of the NCCPA, a longtime PA educator, leader, and former PA program director. So we're looking forward to that. We'll let you know. We will share this recording after we get it edited and put back together in the next day or two. Anyway, thank you all for joining us today, and the best to all of you.
Thanks.